I am. All right, let's open our Bibles to the book of Joshua. Joshua chapter 9. We begin a study today on a group of people called the Gibeonites. In connection with our study of racial humility, this is another illustration. We don't need to pile illustration upon illustration. However, there are good lessons to learn from several of these groups. I mean, it's enough to tell you that the principle of racial integration was acceptable to the nation of Israel, even though in Deuteronomy 7 it appears not to be. We looked at Deuteronomy 7 where it says, hey, the races that are in this land, kill them off. But that is for religious purposes and moral purposes. If any individual or group of individuals within that land area decide to respond in a positive way to truth, spiritual and moral, they will be accepted by the nation of Israel. This was illustrated by the Kenites. This was illustrated by Rahab. Illustrated by Ruth. It's also illustrated by the Gibeonites. Now, we could leave it at that and you'd get the point, but we're going to take some time to look at the Gibeonites because there is a valuable lesson to learn from them. Several lessons to learn in that, for that matter. So, the Gibeonites, it looks like this. G-I-B-E-O-N-I-T-E-S. Looks like that should be bright enough. That's orange. Haven't used it before. Brand new point. Point one. The Gibeonites were a socio-economic group of Amorite and Hivite people. Now, socioeconomic group is simply a technical term to describe that they had organized together for social reasons and economic reasons. We would call it a nation, but it's considerably a small nation. They are a group of Amorite and Hivite people. They're separate races. They're two different races, but they joined together in this group, and they were composed, they were organized into four cities. In four cities in central Canaan. So we are talking about the land of Palestine. You know where we are now. Central Canaan is in the area where you have the two little seas. The Sea of Galilee and then the Dead Sea. You can picture that map in your mind. The four cities, just for those of you who might want it in your notes, are Gibeon, Kephira, actually that's a more of a short I sound, Kephira, Be'erah, and the last city is a compound, Kiriath Jearim. These are the four cities that compose this socioeconomic group. And you can look on a map and you can find these four cities very close together.
I'm having a little trouble
seeing it. Okay. Yeah, all right. Well, I guess I'll retire the orange then. I'll try one of these. Green will show up quite well, probably. How about blue? Blue's
yeah.
Going to shock you.
Yeah.
Oh, you like blue, huh? Point two. This group of people, this group, were positive to the revelation Jehovah's truth. As manifested through the military victories of Israel. You got the other information, didn't you? That you didn't, even though it was life. Okay. This group were group of people were positive. This group was positive. If I change it that way, then I have to say was. We have to be, you know, precise with our English here, otherwise I get criticized. That's a Bible teacher, he can't even speak English right. This group was positive to the revelation of Jehovah's truth as manifested through the military victories of Israel. Therefore, they recognized divine authority over their land and lives. Therefore, they recognized divine authority over their land and lives. You know, the message was to Israel to go in and destroy all the people of Canaan. And this was broadcast. It was made very clear. It was illustrated when Israel conquered Sihon and Og, king of Bashan. It was illustrated also when they conquered Jericho. This takes place after the Battle of Jericho. So it was broadcast to all the people that God had told Israel the land was theirs and they were to dispossess the squatters, those who were in the land. These people, therefore, recognized that God had given them a death sentence. You guys are going to lose your land, you guys are going to lose your lives. But they recognized divine authority. They said, well, he's the boss then, that's the way it's going to be. So if we want to maintain our life, if we want to stay alive, we're going to have to conform to his authority, conform to his policy. All right. Our passage is Joshua chapter 9, 1 through 27. And we will go through it little bit by little bit. We'll start with verses 1 and 2. Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland and on all the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon. Now that's the whole geographical location. Now we have a list of these individual races. The Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. If you take those 6 races and you compare them back with Deuteronomy 7, verse 1, you have the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. 7. With one missing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Wait a minute now, what'd they do? The Girgashite isn't there. Oh, the Hittite isn't in... Yes, he is. So who we got here? This is very technical and very, very important. Hittite, Girgashite. The Girgashite isn't... Oh, I know why. There are 7 in Deuteronomy. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's why. There's 7 in Deuteronomy 7, and there are 6 in Joshua. Okay, that's what threw me off. And the Girgashite is not mentioned. But we're still talking about the same group of people, the same races that were mentioned in Deuteronomy 7, where God said, hey, wipe them out. Now, all these guys heard of it. So, point A, this is all under 2. Point A, under verses 1 and 2, the kings heard. Now, that's a simple point. The kings heard. You cannot make a response to truth until you first hear some information. At the very end of verse 1, heard of it. They heard the information. What did they hear? Well, point one, they heard the same thing Rahab heard. Joshua chapter 2, 9 and 10. In Joshua 2, 9 and 10, what Rahab heard is, verse 10, "For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and to Og, whom you utterly destroyed." So they heard that. Point two, they also heard about Jericho. They also heard about Jericho, which Rahab didn't hear about because, of course, it happened afterwards. But these guys heard about Jericho, which is chapter 9, verse 3. It says, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai. So Jericho plus Ai, which actually in the Hebrew is Ai, rather than I, it's two syllables. So this is the information they heard. Alright, B. Negative response by these kings. They heard this, and they said, "Who cares? We're tougher. We can handle them." Look at verse 2. "That they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel." So all these races and all the kings that gathered together said, "Well, we're not concerned about Jericho and Ai, and we're not concerned about Sihon and Og. We're not even concerned about Egypt and the Red Sea. We are all our kings, see, all our peoples together. We can overcome Israel." So they have a negative response to the information, and they express that negative response by organizing themselves into a physical attack. This reminds me of Psalm 2. I don't know if it reminds you of Psalm 2, but there it says, "The nations and the kings of the earth have organized themselves against Jehovah and against his anointed." They've all taken arms to fight against God. And this is actually what they're doing. They're not fighting just against the nation of Israel. They are fighting against God. And the lesson that we have to learn from this is that many times when we resist physical things that happen in our life, when we resist a physical status that we may find ourselves in, when we resist circumstances that come upon us, and we rebel against those things, we will find ourselves not rebelling against an actual physical situation. We're rebelling against God. Because we have the principle of 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 18, which says, "In everything give thanks, for this everything that has come upon you is God's will for you." So why resist it? Why fight it? Why get upset? Why get out of fellowship and start blaming other people and then eventually blaming God? Well, these people do not accept God's information, God's revelation, and therefore they are seeking to fight against. So you have three words: resistance, rebellion, and antagonism. Resistance. Resistance is a mental word. First area here is resistance in their mind. They hear the information and they say, "No, we don't care that God has claimed authority over our land." The second word is rebellion. Rebellion is mental and overt. Mental and overt. See, it's one thing to resist. Oh, I don't want to hear it. It's another thing to stand up and rebel against it. And then, together you have antagonism. And that antagonism is expressed once again at the end of verse 2. They gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel. Letter C. But the Gibeonites recognize the prerogatives and seek to save their lives accordingly. They recognize God's prerogatives, or the prerogatives of divine authority. He can do what he wants to do. He has the right to dictate policy. So since they recognize that, they're saying, well, what are we going to do about this? God has said the land is his and he's going to wipe us out. Well, why don't we try to, you know, associate with these guys? So, verses 3 through 13, the deception of the Gideonites. The deception of the Gibeonites. What are they going to try and do? Now here you have a group of people who are positive to divine revelation. They don't know what to do about it right now. We could probably equate this with a God consciousness situation. They've become aware of God. God has revealed himself to them from the standpoint of creator authority, and now they have to respond to that information. So under this A and so forth, let's just simply say they are positive to divine authority. This is creature humility. They recognize him as the God of the universe. They recognize him as having more authority than all the gods they worship. And you must realize that this group of people are steeped in idolatry. They have many, many gods they worship, and their idolatry cultivates immorality in their life. We call it the phallic cult, the sexual cult. This is what they are involved with. So they are very evil people. But when they hear the information about God's sovereignty, they respond positive to it. B, but they do not know divine viewpoint. They don't have any divine viewpoint. They don't know his character. They don't know details about his plan. All they know, the only thing they know about his plan, basically, first of all, that he's sovereign, and that in his sovereignty he has decided to destroy the people of the land. So the only thing they can do is try and use their own human viewpoint to protect themselves. They can only use human viewpoint to protect themselves. Now, guess what? All these other groups of people, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, or all these other towns, really, they're using human viewpoint to protect themselves, too. They're getting all their chariots together, all their horses together, whatever they have, all their men of war together. And they're going to use the human viewpoint of military might to overcome the threat. It won't work. These guys, all they have is human viewpoint, but they recognize they can't fight against God, so they have to try and get on God's side. But they're still using human viewpoint to do it. In other words, in their attempt to get on God's side, they're going to deceive Israel. They're going to lie to Israel. And that's using human viewpoint. It's going to turn out for good for them because God will honor positive volition. God will always honor positive volition. And we as babes in Christ are going to be involved with all kinds of deception in our life. We're going to deceive ourselves. We're going to deceive our loved ones. We're going to deceive our friends. We're going to deceive our family members, deceive our fellow employees, and deceive our employers. We're going to deceive many, many people because the human viewpoint solution, 9 times out of 10, is deception. I've got to protect me. And honesty is not the way to do it. Well, these guys, then, it can be understood why they're doing it. What we have to also understand and explain is why God still protects them. Because God is going to honor positive volition. I may not know what to do, but if I'm interested in God, God's going to take care of me and give me the information I need. All right, letter D. They are willing to conform to divine policy as it is represented in Israel. They are willing to conform to divine policy as it is represented in Israel. This is indicated by two things. The phrase, let us make a covenant. They come to Israel and say, let's make a covenant. Well, to make a covenant means they're going to conform to, there's going to be an agreement on two sides. Well, they know Israel's not going to compromise. So they are setting themselves up in the place where they will abide by Israel's policies. So that's what make a covenant. Secondly, they say, let us live in the land. Let us live in the land. That means they're willing to conform to divine policy as it's represented in the land. When Israel takes over, they're going to change the policy that has been practiced in the land all this time. Idolatry, or they're supposed to anyway, aren't they? And so the Gibeonites say, well, all right, we will adjust to this. We're willing to adjust to it. All right, now let's look at it in verses 3 through 13. When the Gibeonites heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet, worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and had become crumbled. They want it to appear as though they have been traveling for a while, and everything is worn out, because they're going to tell Israel, oh, we're not in the land, we're from far away, and we've come, we want to join with you. Verse 6. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, we have come from a far country, and now therefore make a covenant with us. There's one of the key phrases, make a covenant with us. The men of Israel said to the Hivites, that's who these are. These are Hivite people. They're also called Amorite, but not in our passage. They will be called Amorite in 2 Samuel, which we'll probably look at at a later time. Now, the men of Israel said to the Hivites, they didn't know they're Hivites, but they're talking to these groups, these people. They say, perhaps you are living within our land. In other words, they have some suspicion there. Well, now, wait a minute. What if you guys are actually living within our land? How then can we make a covenant with you? But they said to Joshua, we are your servants. Then Joshua said to them, who are you? Where do you come from? And they said to him, your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of Jehovah your God. And we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. Now there is part of their testimony. They use the personal name of Jehovah. They say, we have heard what Jehovah your God has done. They recognize the name. This name has been revealed to them. And notice that says, the fame. If you look at the margin of your New American Standard at the word fame, there's a little footnote there. It says one. You look in the margin down there at verse 9, look at that word. The name of Jehovah. We have heard, we have come because of the name of Jehovah your God. So see, they have heard something about him. They've heard about his reputation and about his claims upon the land. Verse 11. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take provisions in your hand for the journey and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants, now then make a covenant with us. This our bread was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you, but now behold, it is dry and has become crooked. You want some proof, Joshua? Well, look at our bread. It's dry. And these wineskins. Joshua, now, come on now. Who in their common sense, if we were living in the land, would have wineskins like this? Our wineskins, which we filled, were new, and behold, they are torn. And these are clothes and our sandals. Do you think if we were living in the land that we'd dress like a bunch of bums? Joshua looks at this logic and says, you know, you guys got a point there. They're worn out because of the very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Now, this violates a passage in God's instructions to the Israelites. They were to do everything by asking counsel of the Lord. This would have solved the problem. Then the Gibeonites would have had a problem, and they would have had to express their positive volition in a different way. Now, if they had asked counsel of the Lord, if they said, well, God, you know, we've got these guys here, and we don't know what to do with them. They say they're from a far country. They haven't told us what the country is, but, you know, everything's worn out. They've got to be from a long, long way off. What do you think we ought to do? God says, they are deceiving you. Do not make a covenant with them. You know what it would then be? It would then be left up on an individual basis to the Gibeonites, like it was with Rahab. And each individual Gibeonite would have to have come to Israel and accepted their policies and identified with them and professed their faith in Jehovah and Jehovah's policies. But since Joshua and the elders did not take counsel of the Lord, they made their own decision, you have problems developing. All right, first of all, the counsel they violated is Numbers 27:21. And we might as well take time to look at this so you get a complete story. We should focus on the whole passage before us instead of just worrying about the Gibeonites and try to get as much of the passage as we can. It violates Numbers 27:21, which says, moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At this command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. Now that's instructions to them, saying before you leave, before you stop, before you do anything, you ask counsel of the priest, Eleazar. Well, they did not do that. They did not go to Eleazar. They did not go to the priest. Eleazar wasn't there at the time, I don't think. But they didn't go to the priest and say, all right, check with the Urim and the Thummim, or in other words, check with God about this situation. They didn't do it. So Joshua said, well, everything's okay. I can accept human logic. So what's Joshua doing here? Joshua is relying upon his human logic instead of resorting to divine logic, instead of resorting to the plan and character of God, instead of calling upon God, he says, this makes sense to me. How many times do we do that? How many times do we just are confident and relaxed in applying human viewpoint to the situation? Well, that makes sense to me. That sounds logical. I can accept that. And we... How many times do we do that? How many times do we just are confident and relaxed in applying human viewpoint to the situation? Well, that makes sense to me. That sounds logical. I can accept that. And we fail to look into the book and check out what God actually says on the subject, what he says on the situation. How often do we go ahead and make a decision without, first of all, devoting our time to prayer? How many times do we just make the decision without saying, well, Father, you know, I've got this and I've got that. What should I do? Now, of course, when we pray about things, we do not expect God to come down and answer us verbally. But praying about decisions we have to make keeps it in perspective, keeps us recognizing God as the source, God as the authority in our life. Joshua was not doing this at this time. You know, you often think of Joshua not having made very many mistakes, but he did make several mistakes. This is one of them. There are a couple others. He uses human viewpoint to try and answer the situation before him. And, of course, as a result, he fails. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation, they're all in agreement here. They say, well, this makes sense to us, too. They swore. Making of a covenant violates Exodus 23, 32, and 33. So we have another passage that is violated. Exodus chapter 23, 32, and 33. And we can take a quick peek at that. Exodus 23. Verse 32 says, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you. So there you have the commands to not make any covenants with this group of people. Of course, it's the same thing that we have in Deuteronomy chapter 7, 1 through, I believe it was 8. So it's the same passage we already read in connection with the apparent racial segregation that is commanded upon Israel. So they violate, first of all, the principle of seeking counsel from God. Then because they fail to get his input, they do not know the true nature or true racial nature of these people, so they make a covenant with them, thus violating instructions elsewhere. So in other words, what they're inviting upon themselves a snare, according to Exodus 23, a snare and a curse. They're going to cause a lot of problems to themselves. And you don't deal lightly with the negative commands of God. God said, when they went into Jericho, he said, destroy everything. Nothing is to be taken. One man found some pretty little trinkets. He said, these are pretty. I think I'll take them home with me. He took them home with him. He put them in his tent. It's very probable that his family was made aware of it. His wife and his children. And they looked at it and said, this is pretty stuff. Boy, I bet no one else in Israel has something like this. This one violation by one man caused a curse to fall upon the whole nation. And God used it to discipline the nation. And when it was found out that what this man had done, the leaders of Israel had to destroy him, had to have him killed because of this violation. God does not mess around with these kind of violations in the nation of Israel. Now, that doesn't happen in the church, all right? We are not under the same kind of restrictions. When we do something that violates God's policy, we're not going to have the elders of the church take us out back and stone us. But we are going to come under spiritual discipline from God. What is a sad reality is that in many different religions, down through the last 2,000 years, you have people taking the literal instructions applied to the nation of Israel and applying them to the church. So you have the very rigid disciplinary actions of the Quakers. And the Quakers did these things. They were very strong in their discipline of people who stepped out of line in the most minor way, putting them in stocks and then even stoning them at times. All right, well, the snare and the curse, they are inviting. But the thing that is going to turn this curse into blessing, even though Israel has violated policy, is because these people who are the Gibeonites, they are going to be positive to truth. They are going to become believers in the Lord Jesus Christ. And as a result, the potential cursing upon Israel is going to be bypassed by the Father. The Father is going to recognize that in other words, he allows this in order to honor the positive volition of the Gibeonites. If Israel had not done it this way, God would have done it another way. Okay, that brings us to, where are we? Okay, I think we start over now with the verses 14 and 15. Verses 14 and 15. I already read this, but I didn't give it to you in our notes. So, A, we have a covenant, and B, I guess I put this all under another point. No, I didn't. Okay. They make a covenant. Verses 14 and 15. A, they make a covenant, and that violates Numbers 27, 21, which I already gave you. B, they made a covenant. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, I know what I did wrong. All right. A is made a covenant. Actually, it should be B. B is they failed to seek God's counsel. Failed to seek God's counsel. C. If they had consulted, I already gave you C. You've got it in your frame of reference. What C says is that if they had consulted the Lord, then the deception would have been exposed. Then each individual Gibeonite would have had to stand or fall before God on his own merit, in the same way that Rahab and Rahab's family was delivered. God would still have honored their positive volition. He would not have discarded them. These people are willing to change their moral behavior. They're willing to change their overt religious behavior. They're willing to conform to divine policy. This is the initial step that is required. Number one, for salvation. Number two, for growth to maturity. You have to be willing to conform to divine policy. So many times we encounter people who give God lip service, but deep inside they don't really want to conform to what God says. Oh, yeah, I want to learn about the Bible, but if the Bible tells me to do something I don't like, I'm not going to follow through. This is very common with the situations where people who are involved in immorality. We've had several people who have who visited us. And when you make the issues clear that what they're doing, their way of life is immoral, based on what the Bible says, you don't see or hear from them again. They don't want to accept that information. They say, oh, yeah, we're positive to truth. We want to follow God's plan. But when God says, don't do it that way, do it this way, they say, well, no, I think I'll do it my way. Well, this simply indicates rebellion against God. And these people are simply hindering their growth process. Actually, in the two cases I'm thinking of, it's knocked them out of class entirely. They just don't want anything to do with the Bible class. They say, they still give a lip service, they still say, oh yeah, we want to learn, but, you know, they aren't here. And when you deal with the information, they say, well, yeah, I know what I'm supposed to do, I know that's right, but. These people are willing to conform to what God says. And as we study them, we're going to see them for a whole period of many, many generations, similar to what we did with the Kenites. And we're going to see that the Gibeonites even have a closer relationship to the temple and the worship of God, service of God, rather than the Kenites did. Okay, verses 16 and 17. The deception is revealed, simple enough, verse 16 and 17. It came about at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors, and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now they came out there to get to them. Their cities were Gibeon, Kephirah, Be'eroth, and Kiriath Jearim. I already told you that. Jearim, actually. Verse 18. That's too far. Verse 16, 17, simply the point, the deception is discovered. Verse 18, the leaders honor the covenant, but the people complain. Now there's typical for you, huh? How many times do the people complain about what their leaders do? And the sons of Israel did not strike them, because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by Jehovah, the God of Israel. and the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. See, what happens is they march 3 days, and the army has said, "Ah, we're ripe for battle." They've had a little bit of rest, and they're, "Boy, we're ready to take these guys on." And then the leaders come down and say, "Well, we're not going to touch these cities. These cities are off limits. Everything's okay. We made a covenant with them, and we have to honor the covenant." And then the people complain. They say, "Wait a minute, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. We're supposed to destroy these people. How can we make a covenant with them?" All right. There are several things to note about leadership here. The leaders did not go back on their word. They made a covenant. They did not violate that covenant. That's something that's very, very important. Let's record this in verses 19 through 21. This is an explanation of divine viewpoint activity. By honoring the covenant, they are applying divine viewpoint, which is interesting. They did not use divine viewpoint when the crisis arose. They didn't inquire of God. Then they made a covenant, and that was really not using divine viewpoint because the first step wasn't followed. But now, by honoring the covenant and letting these people live, now they are following divine viewpoint. The explanation of it occurs in 19 through 21. We'll put under A, failure in one area does not justify violation in another. Failure in one area does not justify violation in another. I'm a believer. I marry an unbeliever. Failure in one area. All of a sudden, I hear in the Bible. In fact, I decided to start going to Bible class, finally. If I'd gone to Bible class, I wouldn't have got married in the first place. But now I'm going to Bible class, and I find out that the believer is not to marry an unbeliever. And here I am married to a believer. I mean, an unbeliever. And instead of going back next week for the rest of the class to learn that I am not to divorce, I decide, well, I'm married to an unbeliever. I better divorce her. So I go out and divorce her without any delay whatsoever. No, failure in one area does not justify violation in another. I'm not justified in violating in another area. If it does result in violation, and to divorce this person would be a violation. There's no basis for divorce. Once a believer is married, that believer is commanded to remain married at all expenses, at all costs. That believer is under obligation to remain married to that person. The only way out, from his standpoint, is if that person divorces him. Now, even if, you've all heard, well, what about adultery? What if this woman goes out and commits adultery? That still doesn't get you off the hook. The Bible says forgive. Take her back. Take her back again. Take her back a third time. Keep on taking her back. You're under obligation. Well, what happens if she doesn't want to live with me anymore and decides to leave? Well, you have no control over that. If she divorces you, then you are free from that marriage contract. But that is the only way. Oh, there is one other way. If she dies. Well, there's a violation in another. See, failure in one does not justify violation in another. Well, I failed. I married an unbeliever. Does that justify killing her? Maybe. All right. So they made a wrong covenant. But the covenant was made. And when they made a covenant, do you know how Israel made a covenant? We proclaim to you, in the name of Jehovah our God, this is what we're going to do. There's their covenant. So now they turn around, they have a covenant, they say, well, yeah, we use the name of Jehovah in this covenant, but, well, this is a bigger violation than anything, because you have in B to break the covenant would violate commandment Number two, the Ten Commandments. Commandment number two. To violate, or rather to break the covenant would violate commandment number two. Exodus chapter 20, verse 7. You shall not lift up the name of Jehovah your God for the purpose of vanity, for the purpose of emptiness. Lifting up the name does not mean swearing, does not mean saying, oh God, oh, oh Jesus, and all that stuff. Although that is also something that is not to be part of the believer's vocabulary. It is dishonoring to the reputation and character and plan of God. But that's not what this passage is talking about. This passage is talking about making a covenant in the name of Jehovah. And then doing it in vanity, which means you break it. And the commandment number two says don't do it in vanity. Don't break it. Okay. Now, verse 19. Look at verse 19. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by Jehovah, the God of Israel. So see, I wasn't just telling you that they did that as a rule. This is exactly what they did. It says, they're telling the people. Now they're explaining to the people, hey, you guys, put your stones down. Will you listen? We made a covenant with them. We swore to them in the name of Jehovah our God, or Jehovah the God of Israel. Now we cannot touch them. See, these guys have some information. They have a lot of divine viewpoint. This generation is really right on the ball. It just was a miscalculation when they failed to inquire of God. It was Joshua's responsibility. He was the boss. He should have said, well, elders, before we make a decision, check it out with the priest. But no, he said, this makes sense to me. Took it into his own hands, made a wrong decision. But now these people recognize that they cannot touch these people. They made a covenant. That covenant stands. That covenant must be held up. Verse 20. This we will do to them, even let them live, lest wrath be upon us for the oath which we swore to. See, they recognize that if they break their oath, they're going to be in big trouble from God. So they're going to let them live. Verse 21, the leader said to them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood, drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Okay, now, that's probably a good place to stop. We've got these people off the hook. They're not going to be killed. They get to stay in the land. The elders are off the hook. We have the congregation putting their stones down. And so we'll leave them there, and next time we'll pick up at verses 22 through 27, confrontation with the deceivers. There is an accounting. We're going to go to these guys and say, now what's the meaning of this? What's this you've pulled? Why have you done this? And they're going to give a testimony. They're going to say, well, really, because we honor Jehovah. And we knew that Jehovah was going to kill us, so we figured we have to associate with you so Jehovah wouldn't kill us. That's basically what they say. Anyway, that's what we'll pick up tomorrow. Yeah.